let's turn the floor over to this guy in order to get a feel for all of this. So, starting on page one, we good? Okay. How many of you actually have it with you? Okay. Good. All right. How many don't? All right. So you're just going to keep record of it. All right. Today it seems to me providential that fate should have chosen Braunau on the Inn as my birthplace. For this little town lies in the boundary between two German states, which we of the younger generation, at least, have made it our life work to reunite by every means at our disposal. So, right there, you've got this issue of the German problem. Right up front, central. We've talked about it in general terms, and we've experienced it in the, you know, in specifically when we hear the language of Dietrich. But this is, you know, something that Germans, even today, have to think about. You know, it's a quandary. What is German? And Bismarck identified that small German option, but the large German option is always out there to a certain degree. And here it is, yeah, the first thing he mentions. Right? The first thing he mentions. German Austria must return to the greater German mother country, which he would have called fatherland. It's kind of funny they translated that. And not because of any economic consideration. One blood demands one Reich. Right? So there's the racial identification of what is German. And that is a big, big territorial definition. Because you have, you know, from the Middle Ages on, or from the Dark Ages on, you have German blood going as far as what we would think of as Russia, and through all the Polish lands, and in the Sudetenland, and so on. If you can identify it by blood, it even includes Milwaukee, right? By that time, and a large part of northern, what was northern Chicago in the time. Never will the German nation possess the moral right to engage in colonial politics until at least it embraces its own sons within a single state. That's significant. Hitler does not care about colonies. Wilhelm II cared about colonies. Bismarck had not cared about colonies, right? Hitler's global politics, geopolitics, focus on the situation of Germany in Central Europe. Frankly, I don't think he cares about France and the other side of the Rhine. The reason you invade, defeat, and occupy France is to stabilize your western flank so that you can take care of the real issue. And the real issue is Central Europe. It's expanding German boundaries to the place where bloodlines would require. And then taking control of Polish territories, Slovakian territories, Balkans, and so on and so forth. So that you have the resources to keep that state alive without having access to foreign colonies. This is the geopolitical plan. And we'll get to it, but since it's right there, it's already there, we'll get more on it. But this is what they're talking about when they use this key phrase, Lebensraum, living space. Now, in some of the hyperbole, in some of the songs and so on, and especially in, we'll say, American propaganda, which was necessary in order to get Americans on board to fight that war, which they did not want to fight, did not want to get involved with until after Pearl Harbor, there is this notion that Hitler's plan was global dominance and that Americans' frontiers were threatened by this guy from the get-go. But that wasn't the case. Hitler's concern was Central Europe and establishing a state which would obviously include all of Germans under by this broad bloodline definition, and then the territories add to that the control of the territories from which it could derive its grain, its oil, its other resources in order to keep that state alive, so that it could never again be blockaded the way it had been blockaded in the First World War. Living space is room for this whole German state to exist as efficiently as possible without external trade, without the need for global trade. England would have been left with its empire. England's happy with its empire. Hitler was happy with England's empire. No problem. You can have Africa and you can have the Middle East and so on and so forth. Oil might have changed that over time, but if he could have the oil resources of the Caucasus and so on, it might not have worked, but it would probably have been satisfactory at the time. America would have had the Western Hemisphere, including Latin America, and Japan would have had the Eastern. No problem. That's Hitler's. That's the initial plan. Now, we hear later that there may have been plans drawn up for attacking the United States, right? But that's because we're supplying Britain, right? That's not the original plan. Okay. Only when the Reich borders include the very last German, but can no longer guarantee his daily bread, will the moral right to acquire foreign soil arise from the distress of our own people. Okay, so that's tricky. We expand the Reich border so that every last German is there. And only if we're in trouble after we do that are we going to take up the sword against others. All right, so that's it's a veiled threat. If we can hold it together and we don't need the resources of these other territories, we won't have to invade. But, you know, if we're having a little trouble with that, then we'll do it. Okay, so this is the first paragraph. I spent some time on it, but it's you know, all the issues are there in terms of the foreign policy and so on. Okay, down at the bottom, a little bit of myth-making about his own oratorical skills. Remember, he's risen up in the Munich scene on the basis of these oratorical skills that he has. So he highlights those. Where did those come from? This is his image, right? The great speaker. I believe that even then my oratorical talent was being developed in the form of more or less violent arguments with my schoolmates. Hitler was a hell of a schoolmate. I had become a little ringleader. At school I learned easily and at that time very well, but was otherwise rather hard to handle. Okay, so he emphasizes that aspect of his youth. Since in my free time I received singing lessons in the cloister at Lambach, I had excellent opportunity to intoxicate myself with the solemn splendor of the brilliant church festivals. So there our cultural historical ears prick up because, you know, he's looking at those church festivals, he's looking at those rituals, he's looking, you know, we can assume where he's getting those ideas that will become important in the construction of those rallies. Then we have the presence of this military culture in late 19th century, early 20th century, educational as well as, let's say, pedagogical world. Now, we know Dietrich was influenced by a sort of nationalistic tilt among the fraternities and so on, and we heard that Paul Boehme was influenced by Kantorek, the teacher. And so you have politics and education are overlap in German as well as French society, and Hitler's a product of that. He's a product of that, and we get an indication of that. Rummaging through my father's library, I had come across various books of a military nature, among them a popular edition of the Franco-Prussian War of 1870 and 1871. Right? So kids were just inundated with this stuff. Fathers have these books on their bookshelves, and they're getting it at school. And so that military, nationalistic, patriotic education was very common, and he comes out of that. From then on, I became more and more enthusiastic about everything that was any way connected with war, or for that matter, with soldiery. Right? So we have his oratorical skills, we have his interest in the arts and music, and particularly the rituals of the festivals, and we have this nationalistic orientation. You know, those are the elements that go into making them up. And again, not uncommon. Right? Was there a difference? And if so, what a difference between the Germans who fought these battles and other Germans? Why hadn't Austria taken part in this war? Why hadn't my father and all the others fought? Are we not the same as all other Germans? Do we not all belong together? So the experience of looking through this materials, those are the things that are on his mind. At least he claims later. But as a boy, he's already thinking about those things. And I don't think there we don't have to doubt him. Right? That was just the world that they came up in. Okay. A little bit further, a little hint here. Barely 11 years old, I was forced into opposition for the first time in my life. What's the issue? He doesn't want to become a civil servant. Now, ironically, what does he become? A civil servant, right? But he bitches about that endlessly. He's always complaining about the fact that he had to take over this political job and run this country, and he can't be the artist that he wants to be. And this is just part of his shtick. It's part of his personality. And he drove his minions crazy with this. One example being he's always wanted to play with Speer and his architectural designs. Another being he wanted to stay up all night. It was his artistic nature to stay up till 3 in the morning watching Hollywood movies. Right? And then he would sleep in till noon. Right? So... And he said, well, that's just my art. I got used to that as an artist. This is the way I do these things. So, these elements play themselves out. Okay, on page 3, then we hear that he doesn't know, but one day it became clear to me that I would become a painter and an artist. So we know for sure that that was his goal from very early on. But for political circumstances... the most important is that his best accomplishments were in geography and even more so in history, middle of page 3. These were my favorite subjects in which I led the class. I don't know if we have class records to check that, but there you are. If I examine the results of this period, I regard two outstanding facts as particularly significant. First, I became a nationalist, and second, I learned to understand and grasp the meaning of history, okay, which is... You know, how we got into this situation with a divided Germany. So all of that should be familiar to you after this course. I mean, this is common knowledge. Someone who understands turn of the century to early 20th century German culture is part of that. Now let's move to the school, page 4. Just a little reminder: while he's at school, this is kind of garbled in the scan, but. At the school, collections are taken for the Sudmark and the school or association. We emphasized our convictions by wearing cornflowers in red, black, and gold colors. So the politicization of education, right? Nash, patriotic stuff in school. Heil was our greeting. And instead of the imperial anthem, we sang Deutschland über alles, despite warnings and punishments. Okay? So he's involved with pan-German, large German student culture, like the fraternities, right? And they're incorporating the song, the Deutschland über alles, instead of singing the Austrian national anthem, right? So he's anti-Austrian, pro-United German. And he just throws in, Heil was our greeting. So the Nazis did not invent Heil, right? Hail to the leader, Heil Führer. That was around. He picks that up from grade school. Okay. On the bottom of page 4, we have his teacher. He used our budding nationalistic fanaticism as a means of educating us, frequently appealing to our sense of national honor. Well, there's the teacher in All Quiet on the Western Front. There's Cantorek, right? A common character in turn of the century European culture. French as well as German. The French are over there screaming about Alsace and Lorraine. You know, before the First World War. Same thing. Okay, let's turn to page 5. And here we have this cultural turn, which is so important. At an early age, I had become a political revolutionary, and I became an artistic revolutionary at an equally early age. At the age of 12, I saw Wilhelm Tell, which is Schiller. things would be better if he paid more attention to Schiller than Wagner, but for the first time. And a few months later, my first opera, Lohengrin. I was captivated at once. My youthful enthusiasm for the master of Bayreuth knew no bounds. Again and again, I was drawn to his works, and it still seems to me especially fortunate that the modest provincial performances left me open to an intensified experience later. So here he tells us about this Wagner obsession, which is, we've talked about it, but a very important component of his outlook, but also his plans. I mean, he is dedicated, as we're going to see, to building opera houses that are going to be the perfect place to perform Wagner's music. With the passing years, he became more interested in architecture. So we have that Wagnerian interest in music, and perhaps that influences his own style later on, oratory. Wagnerian's influence on perhaps the design of the rallies and that total work of art that they turn out to be, right? Integrating all of those elements into a real show, a real spectacle. He understands that. And not to mention what Wagner, ostensibly wrote about and what the storylines of these operas might have meant. And then there's his personal interest and capacity in architecture. Now, on page 6, he loses his father in his 13th year at the top, and then he loses his mother 2 years later. Poverty and hard reality now compelled me to take a quick question. What little my father had left had been largely exhausted by my mother's grave illness. The orphan's pension to which I was entitled was not enough for me even to live on, so I was faced with the problem of somehow making my own living. In my hand, a suitcase full of clothes and underwear, in my heart, an indomitable will, I journeyed to Vienna. So off to the city. I wanted to become something, but on no count a civil servant like his father. So he's off to the big city, and he's got this, he's down and out right from the start. Now, we know that pension wasn't so bad. He wasn't destitute by any means. But he presents himself as someone who'd really seen the dregs and really been at the bottom and understood it from the ground up. A little bit of myth-making. But still, he goes off to the city to try to make it on his own. And of course, the city has a tremendous impact on him. Okay. Page 7. Years of study and suffering in Vienna. Suffering in Vienna. Now, if we were to drop him in the loop or something like that, his mind would probably have fried. So you go to Vienna and it's not that big a city, and it's not a big industrial mega city by any means, even today. Right? But still, he is profoundly impacted by the experience of being in an urban environment of the masses, and of the economy of a larger city. And this coordinates with a lot of this folkish resistance to modernity, to modernization, to capitalism, as well as socialism on the other side, industrialization, and he taps right into that right into this rejection of what, I think I use this term talking about Dublin, asphalt culture. People on the streets in these urban worlds. And we have a number of pages of that. He had gone to Vienna to take the entrance examination for the academy. So there's that goal of becoming an artist. A little bit more on that in a second. When he got there, he could stand in front of the opera for hours. Okay. For hours, he could gaze at the Parliament. The whole Ring Boulevard seemed to me like an enchantment out of 1001 Nights. This is significant. I had something I didn't log in. I'll look it up again real quick. Ringstrasse, Vienna. If somebody has a couple of pictures up here. There. Okay. So it's a lot of big bureaucratic buildings for the university, for the city government, opera, museum, and so on, built around the medieval center of Vienna. That's why it's called the Ring, because it was the defensive area, military defensive area, and then they built it up in the end of the 19th century. So, I mean, to you, it looks like the Field Museum, or it looks like the Art Institute. This is his favorite architecture. He just loves this stuff, these big bureaucratic buildings that quote classical and Gothic style, neo-Gothic and neoclassical. That's his standard that he feels is healthy, German, monumental art. So he loves that, he tells us here. Now, he's in the city again with confidence and assurance for the result of his entrance examination. I was so convinced that I would be successful. Then when I received my rejection, it struck me as a bolt from the blue. All right. Well, I've told you this story, right? But let's turn for a second to why he might have thought that he would get in. Now, these are probably not the things that he submitted, but the kind of things that he did after being rejected when he's on the streets. That's by Hitler. That's a paint or a watercolor of a famous church that's on the Ringstrasse. And the Karlskirche. And it's a neoclassical design. You can see the columns and the dome and so on and so forth. And this is the kind of thing that he would do those watercolors and sell them on the street. And here is just a shot of a sort of a quasi-Gothic scene. And I think I have one more. So he could do watercolors, right? He could do realistic copies of architectural settings. But he didn't get in. This hurled him, despite all resistance, into a world of misery and poverty, just making me acquainted with those for whom I was later to fight. Okay, so he's trying to touch with the real people by saying that. In this period, my eyes were opened to two menaces, of which I had previously scarcely known the name, and whose terrible importance for the existence of the German people I certainly did not understand. Marxism and Jewry. So it's in response to this personal crisis and response to the experience of the city that he latches onto these two menaces. Now again, they were around, and I mean that we know that. He didn't invent anti-Marxism, he didn't invent Jewry, and he didn't invent putting them together. But in search of some sort of explanation for what had happened to him, right, there they are. To me, Vienna, the city which to so many is the epitome of innocent pleasure, a festive playground for merrymakers, represents, I'm sorry, merely the living memory of the saddest period of my life. And in order to deal with that, he latches onto or projects the causes onto Marxists and Jews. It's clear. I mean, you don't have to be a psychoanalyst to figure that one out. Next page, 8. Top. In this period, there took shape within me a world picture and a philosophy. Now here's the speech, here's the stump speech, which became the granite foundation of all my acts. Here's where that language starts to show up. There's all this trouble, and it's the Jews and the city and the communists and blah, 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 blah. But I have a world picture and a philosophy which provides a granite foundation, stability, order, structure. You can just hear Franz saying, we got to get order, we got to get order, we got to get order. That's what he's saying. We got to get order, right? And he develops this picture. And he also knows that people on the street down there, they want that. Because they feel like their world is just topsy-turvy and confusing and disorienting and so on and so forth. So he knows it from experience because he feels it himself. We need a granite foundation to stabilize things. And I'll underline all those, I mean, as many as I can, how that order comes through, this language of order. Let me get through Vienna, and then we'll take a break. After the turn of the century, Vienna was, socially speaking, one of the most backward cities in Europe, he says. Right? Dazzling riches and loathsome poverty alternated sharply. So he's looking at, you know, the underclasses, the impoverished, and that's what disturbs him. And especially the disjunct between those impoverished people and the wealthy at the top. And of course, that's disturbing to anybody. You go into a big city and you see homeless people. You know, you go from a small town, you don't see them that much. But you go to the city, suddenly you see people on the street, and you're like, whoa, this is weird. Right next to the Trump Tower? You know, Lower Wacker, Trump Tower. I don't know if they're still down under there, but they were. Outside of the palaces on the ring loitered thousands of unemployed. And beneath this Via Triumphalis of old Austria dwelt the homeless in the gloom and the mud of canals. So that freaked him out, like it does anybody, right, I would say. Page 9. Among these immigrants we must count not only those who go to America, but to an equal degree the young farmhand who resolves to leave his native village for the strange city. He is prepared to face an uncertain fate. As a rule, he arrives in the big city with a certain amount of money. He has no need to lose heart on the first day if he has the ill fortune to find no work for any length of time. But it is worse if, after finding a job, he soon loses it. To find a new one, especially in winter, is often difficult, if not impossible. Even so, the first weeks are intolerable. He receives an unemployment benefit from his union funds and manages as well as possible. When his last cent is gone and the union, due to long duration of his unemployment, discontinues its payments, great hardships just begin. Well, that you can hear that in a lot of stump speeches right now, right? Here's your story of those down and out people that need help. Right? And of course, he can say, I was one of them as well. So tapping that in, but also I think this description, he's describing those Franzes out there, right? Those guys down and out. Now this is before the First World War. But just the urban environment, describing that. With open eyes, on page 10, I was able to follow this process in 1,000 examples. The more I witnessed it, the greater grew my revulsion for the big city, which first avidly sucked men in and then so cruelly crushed them. So here's this anti-modernism, anti-urbanism, anti-modernization. He's representative. It's not new, but he's clearly shares that with what the folkish movement has been saying already. The city's a dangerous thing. This asphalt culture is a blight that needs to be destroyed. The misery in which the Viennese day laborer lived was frightful to behold. Even today it fills me with horror when I think of those wretched caverns, the lodging houses and tenements, sordid scenes of garbage, repulsive filth, and worse. Now, bottom of page 10. All right, there's the problem, very complicated. We're still trying to figure it out in the United States today. How are you going to do it? Right. Even then, I saw that only a twofold road could lead to the goal of improving these conditions. Clear, twofold road. Okay, here's that language that he knows is so impressive. He says it in his propaganda theory sections, and he was applying it. Got all this complication, but provide a twofold load. The deepest sense of social responsibility for the creation of better foundations for our development. That's one. Right? So you should have a social responsibility to work for better conditions. Coupled with brutal determination on breaking down incurable tumors. Okay? Well, there's the language of, you know, vicious political policies imposed with violence. In order to kill the cancer of this urban blight. So you've got this strong, clear response with both disciplined work and a vicious attack applied right away. But it's general. It's very general. I mean, how are you going to figure that policy out? What's the policy? You know, brutal determination. I mean, it's vague. It's vague. Okay, let's pick up at page 14. Now, in the city, he said that he's noticed a couple of things that bother him in particular, and I want you to pay attention not just to what he's seen, we know that, it's the language. That's what we're trying to get a feel of here. Right? the language that Dublin used to describe the city, the language that Heinrich Mann used to set forth the problems of pre-war Germany, the language that Remarque used to tell us what it was like to be at the front, right? That's the fascinating thing here. And here, the language that Hitler was using at that time, because this is what he's using in the speeches as well. Up to that time, I had known the Social Democratic Party only as an onlooker at a few mass demonstrations. So he went to political rallies and he observed other politicians in their work. That's another thing that he's picking up there. Right? He's a student in retrospect. He probably didn't know he was going to do that, but in retrospect, he was picking up how did the right wing do it? How does the left wing do it? What are the methods that they use to get their demonstrations some attention and so forth? I'd only been an onlooker at a few social democratic demonstrations without possessing even the slightest insight into the mentality of its adherents or the nature of its doctrine. But now, at one stroke, I came into contact with the products of his education in philosophy, and in a few months I obtained what might otherwise have required decades, an understanding of a, and here's where you go, whoa, wait a minute, pestilential whore. Cloaking herself as social virtue and brotherly love, from which I hope humanity will rid this earth with the greatest dispatch, since otherwise the earth might be well become rid of humanity. Okay, so there's this. This is, I think, the first example of this. Of first of all, sexual innuendo, sexual threat, right? Very powerful, you know, psychological intensity. Right, to draw on those sexual imagery, and then pestilence, the notion of a medical threat, of germs and illness. Right? And both of these things are going to be attached to both the left and to the Jews with great effect. And again, he's not inventing that, but he's, you know, he really does it. And we have this right at the very beginning, dehumanization of the enemy. As both sexual deviants and literally diseases that have to be eliminated. It's a two-pronged attack, but it's often mixed like this. Okay, so page 18. It really shifts over to the Jewish problem. First of all, he concatenates them with social democracy. Only a knowledge of the Jews, bottom of page 18, provides the key with which to comprehend the inner and consequently real aims of social democracy. Okay? So, bing, the Jews are behind social democracy. The Jews are behind socialism.
Right. Was there any actual truth that a significant number of Jewish people living in Germany were social democrats? It's just a coincidence in the two books. Do you
know? It's an intricate. I have to say that in all the studies that I've read about the actual presence of Jewish people of Jewish heritage in German society. Right? They, of course, they're a vast minority in any group. Right? They're statistically overrepresented in some, right? Like education and intellectual law. Right? But they are by no means dominant in any of these areas. Now, are they statistically overrepresented on the left? I would venture to say, if there are such statistics, that they would say no. Are they statistically overrepresented among capitalists? Right? No. But that cultural prejudice, right? Of course, the notion that they're behind capitalism is because of their the notion that they're bankers, which is they're usurers, which goes back to the Middle Ages. That's where that comes from. That exists beforehand. The Rosa Luxemburg was Polish Jewish, for instance. There were some high profile Jewish leaders on the left, which probably contribute to that. Marx himself, right? Self-hating Jew, right? So I'm just, you know, I don't have a pat answer. I don't know if I can say yes or no. But they may have been overrepresented in some of the leadership positions of the Socialist Party. I'm thinking of Edward Bernstein, too. Now, I'm not sure that's a Jewish name, but it could be. So that's possible.
Okay,
right.
So I'm just curious.
Yeah. You know, I haven't read someone actually interpret that particular connection, you know, as a cultural construct. Why the left? You know, I've read, you know, about the sexuality and the banking and so on and so forth. It's just presumed at the time.
Well, yeah. I assume at the time that there'd be no difference in religion and left or right is all of them. So I was just curious. Maybe it's just
I mean, I think I kind of want to be careful about this, but in every stereotype, there's a grain of truth. You know, and you can find examples which they could use, right, in order to justify what their position is. You know, you find those evidence of that overrepresentation. You find the Rosa Luxemburgs. You find the Edward Bernsteins. You look at Marx. You know, bing. And then it becomes a Jewish conspiracy, no matter what the rest of the statistics might show. But I mean, it is important to know what the origins of these are as cultural constructs. I still think they're cultural constructs for the most part when you get right down to it. So would it help to actually get the statistics from the social democratic movement from 1880 to 1914, for instance? Would it really help to say, you know what, they weren't overrepresented, right? You can prove that. You know, and then you're rationally satisfied, like you can prove that Hitler was or wasn't of Jewish origin. But it doesn't change what happened. The image of it was there, and worked, unfortunately. Right. But that's, I mean, the message is we have to watch out for those constructs and be alert to them, whether they're true or not. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
No, but it is the question is. To our ears, so many of these things just seem beyond the pale. How is it that educated Germans of every socioeconomic level, at least, let's say, a third, 25% of them, at some point say, I could live with that, right? Now, some of them are in denial. They say, well, that's the Jewish things over here in the corner, but the other stuff is why I voted for them, and so on and so forth. So the real question is how these things work, how the impact that how it actually drew the attack attention, right, and were convincing to people. And I think the important thing to know is that he's tapping into pre-existing elements. It doesn't matter whether it was actually true when he was saying it; it was in the air already. And maybe that's the biggest message to everything we've done up to this part, to the extent that it points at Hitler, is that there was precedent for this, and he was just tapping into this stuff. He didn't have to know it. He didn't have to have proof of it. He didn't even have to experience it. He was just using imagery that was already around. So, with that said, he tells us, not until my 14th or 15th year did I begin to come across the word Jew with any frequency, partly in connection with political discussions. At the time, this filled me with a mild distaste, and I could not rid myself of the unpleasant feeling that always came over me whenever religious quarrels occurred in my presence. Okay. Now, so he's heard about it sometimes in political conversation. But in the early days, in his early days, the Jew was still characterized for me by nothing but his religion. And therefore, on grounds of human tolerance, I maintain my rejection of religious attacks in this case as in others. Right. So there's cultural or religious anti-Semitism. That's the first phase. And that's, you know, he was familiar with that early on. Now, what's going to change, and what he's arguing through Mein Kampf in these passages, is that that is an obsolete and naive way to look at the Jewish problem, because he sees it as a racial problem, not as a religious one. Right? And that's the shift, and he articulates that shift. He wasn't responsible for it, he picked it up, but... And he says, since in those days, a little bit further down from that, about 10 lines, I saw Vienna in that light, I thought myself justified in accepting this explanation of mine as a valid excuse. So he's saying, well, I thought that way before, but I was mistaken, but that's what I thought. You can't blame me, because in Vienna, that's just the way I saw things. My opinion changes later. Okay, so on page 20, we hear about, and they're highlighted here, anti-Semitic papers that existed. And you hear about Karl Lueger and the Christian Social Party. This is proof that he's just tapping into that anti-Semitic stream that pre-existed. Said so many times, but it is very important. Now, at the bottom of page 20, he articulates this shift. I could no longer very well doubt that the objects of my study were not Germans of a special religion, but a people in themselves. Here's the racism. Vienna appeared to me in a different light than before. Wherever I went, I began to see Jews, and the more I saw, the more sharply they became distinguished in my eyes from the rest of humanity. So now he's describing that shift. He's correcting that error that he had made before. Particularly in the inner cities and the districts north of the Danube, swarmed with a people which even outwardly had lost all resemblance to Germans. Okay, so now he's seeing that Jewishness is not a religious thing, but a physical thing. Right. So right there he describes his taking that step, which is pivotal. Now, page 21. Key for us cultural historians of National Socialism. The cleanliness of this people, moral and otherwise, I must say, is a point in itself. So they're morally despicable, right, dirty. Their very exterior could tell you that they were no lovers of water, and to your distress, you often knew it with your eyes closed. Okay, so they smell different, they look different. Now what... the seed... the kernel of truth to this physical anti-Semitism was the in presence over the 19th century in certain areas of Eastern Jews, Eastern Orthodox Jews that had come out escaping Russia and Poland and so on. That's taken place over the 19th century. So there are Jews that live in a traditional way. In Chicago, our experience is if you go up to Skokie, you see Hasids. So they dress differently and they eat differently and so on and so forth. There were Eastern Jews in neighborhoods of Vienna and in Berlin and so on. And whether he's actually seeing them or not, that fed into the stereotyping. Okay. So this visual image of the Jew, which is based on observations of very Orthodox, very traditional Eastern Jews, that becomes the basis for the physical image of Jewry as a whole. There they are. Okay, that's what becomes the poster child for this problem. You know, the physiological definition of the problem. Now, the fact is, most Germans had not seen these traditional Jews from the East. Out there in the hinterland, they're not out there in the farm areas and so on and so forth. There may be Jews out there, but they look just like Germans. So they construct this image of the terrifying, ugly Jew, which is the opposite of the perfect Aryan neoclassical ideal. Nervous, smelly, bearded, masturbating, chasing white women, all the things that are attached to them, right? As opposed to the clean-cut Aryan Greek god.
Right? There's the distinction. And that image has, you know, great propaganda value, visual, graphic, artistic propaganda value. And then the population has this image of that's the enemy. So when they're talking about Jews, that's what you visualize, and that's what you think should be eradicated. Right? And it may come as a surprise when they pull your blue-eyed, blonde-haired neighbors out 10 years later. And because those policies have been put in place and the basis of this kind of visual iconography. See, that's the tricky part. Because later on, if it's really racial, it doesn't even matter what you look like. It's just that you can trace that your grandmother was Jewish. Right? If you're a quarter or whoever's deciding what the percentage would be.
So it's a slippery slope. And here you can see the beginnings of it. Because he's tapping into that and then obviously intensifying it. In a short time, I was made more thoughtful than ever by my slowly rising insight into the type of activity carried on by the Jews in certain fields. Okay. Now remember, up to this point, we've heard that other people were talking about the political involvement, their involvement on the left, also capitalism. Their social impact and their religious, right? But for him, the cultural element becomes key. And I'm not, obviously he didn't add to this, but this is really where it hits home for Hitler. Because remember, he didn't get into the school, and he's looking for an explanation for that. He sees that there's a conspiracy theory, a notion that the Jews are behind these other things that are a problem. But his particular problem is the cultural world. Why didn't I get into art school? Right? In a short time, I was made for... My slowly rising insight in the type of activity carried on by the Jews in certain fields. Was there any form of filth or profligacy, particularly in cultural life, without at least one Jew involved in it? If you cut even cautiously into such abscesses, there's that physical issue of disease, you found, like a maggot in a rotting body, often dazzled by the sudden light, a kike. What had to be reckoned heavily against the Jews in my eyes was when I became acquainted with their activity in the press, art, literature, and the theater. That's what got me. That was what opened my eyes. All the unctuous reassurances helped little or nothing. It sufficed to look at a billboard, to study the names of the men behind the horrible trash they advertised, to make you hard for a long time to come. This was pestilence, spiritual pestilence. So there's that medical language. Worse than the Black Death of olden times. And the people was being infected with it. It goes without saying that the lower the intellectual level of one of those art manufacturers, the more unlimited his fertility will be, and the scoundrel ends up like a garbage separator picker, splashing his filth in the face of humanity. Now you see, I mean, this language, this is where he goes crazy. Yeah, and in these speeches and so on. Spiritual pestilence, the Black Death, splashing their filth in the face of humanity. Right. These would be these high points in the presentation where he just goes nuts. Right? And it's often associated with this cultural problem that he perceives. Not just modernization in the cities, but the modernism of the art world. Right? They're responsible for that. Now, at the bottom of page 21, just to heap it on, the relation of the Jews to prostitution, and even more to the white slave traffic, could be studied in Vienna as perhaps in no other city of Western Europe. So then you get the sexual element added to that, or intensified. And that white slave traffic, I can tell you, being one of the few people who's looked at every page in the Völkische Beobachter, they don't stop harping on that to the end. There's always some little article down there about the fact that the Jews are taking white women off and doing things to them, or that they're doing these blood rituals. And they just keep insisting that stuff's going on at some level. So you have the cultural and the sexual added there as well. Okay, let's go to 24, sort of a little closure on this. If, with the help of his Marxist creed, the Jew is victorious over the other peoples of the world, his crown will be the funeral wreath of humanity, and this planet will, as it did thousands of years ago, move through the ether devoid of men. Eternal nature inexorably avenges the infringement of her commands. Hence, today I believe that I'm acting in accordance with the will of the Almighty Creator by defending myself against the Jew. I am fighting for the work of the Lord. So it doesn't get much stronger than that. You can see this would be one of these moments when he's just, you know, going crazy, and you know, his eyeballs are puffing out, and the tendons in his neck are taut, and so forth. And he invokes this religious language. Now, of course, the issue of Nazism and institutional religion in Germany is a complicated one. But that's not really what we're talking about here. We're talking about this sacralization of hatred. How's that? I mean, he's this ritualistic element, the power of that kind of language to impress people at an emotional level. And he's willing to use it. He's not he's not Christian. He's not a believer. He's a, you know, he's a 20th century man, but he uses this language when he needs to. Not always, but when he needs to. And you also have to remember, whenever you take a look at the Nazis and consider their situation, especially in the early days, Bavaria is very Catholic. So they have to be careful. Right? They can align themselves to a certain degree, but their general discourse was, I would say, irreligious as a whole. They do present themselves as revolutionary and socialist in their own way. So they have to walk a fine line, but they can't go so far as to blaspheme. But that's all separate from this use of biblical kind of language as a propaganda tool. It's powerful. You can see that he had no reservation doing it. Okay, now let's see about what his general considerations are on page 25. It is my conviction that in general, aside from cases of unusual talent, a man should not engage in public political activity before his 13th year. So anyway, he has these strong convictions. Only after he has acquired such a basic philosophy and the resultant firmness of outlook on the special problems of the day is he, inwardly at least, mature enough to be justified in partaking in the political leadership of the general public. So here's that search for order. He's gone through another sequence of talking about all these problems, and then he says, but, you know, from all of this, I acquired a basic philosophy with resultant firmness on the special problems of the day. Right? So it's almost, I haven't gone through it, but you have that sort of that duality going on between his some maniacal articulation of the problems, modernity, modernism, Jews, communists, socialists, and so on, and then balance, order, stability, things in granite. So he goes back and forth between those two extremes. A little bit more on the horrors of modern artistic development on page 26. Aside from the trash of the more modern artistic development which a nation of Negroes might just as well have produced, the German alone possessed and disseminated a truly artistic attitude. In music, architecture, sculpture, and painting, Vienna was the source supplying the entire dual monarchy in inexhaustible abundance without ever seeming to go dry itself. So he does like the traditional art of Vienna, those buildings that I showed you on the Ringstrasse, and he does draw from that. He still sees that as valuable, as that's the German approach or the Aryan style. Gothic and classical. They claim both of those traditions as theirs, historically, in contrast to the modernist development. I won't reread that. Right. Now on page 28, just a little aside, just, you know, a little piece at the bottom. He goes inside the Austrian Parliament, which is one of these new buildings that's been constructed on the Ringstrasse. Okay? And he likes the building. He hates what's going on inside of it, all that parliamentary bickering and so on and so forth. We'll get some of that coming. But he likes the building. These were my inner sentiments when, for the first time, I set foot in these halls, as hallowed as they were disputed. For me, to be sure, they were hallowed only by the lofty beauty of the magnificent building. A Hellenic miracle on German soil. He loves the neoclassical. A lot of German right-wingers, folkish thinkers, love the romantic, and there's plenty of romantic in National Socialism. The singing and the rituals and the blood and the flames and so on and so forth. And Hitler used that. But he also used the Hellenic, the Greek, the classical. And this is really was his preference. Because that conveys that sense of order, that sense of structure, the 25 points, the philosophy that's made of granite, and so on. Right? That's the imagery that he actually tapped into. And let me just show you a couple of examples of his interest in that. Here he is, for instance, going through and deriding all the modernist art. They gather it all together, put it in an exhibit hall in Munich. This is after they're in power, 1937-38, and put all sorts of derogatory statements on along the wall: Dadaist, Futurist, Expressionist, Otto Dix, George Kolsch, and so on and so forth. And then the plan was to have that stuff all destroyed. Now Goebbels didn't destroy it all; he secretly put it on the art market, which is why it ends up in the Art Institute eventually. Because he was smart enough to know that it would make some money, and actually he didn't think the expressionists were so bad himself. So, you know, there's this this attack on modernism, and let me just do this and then I'll answer your question. Right? And the opposite of that is what he likes. With his own money, he made money. How did he make money? No, well, that went to the party probably, but his personal income came from Mein Kampf. Right? So on his, tax returns, Hitler puts himself down as author. Now what I'll show you when that thing cycles around is with that money he donated to the arts. That's what he did. It was a fund, a Hitler fund, and he donated to composers and to writers and so on and so forth. That was his particular interest. And but he also made some purchases with his own money for the German state. And he bought the original Discobolus, which I was going to show you him standing in front of the disc thrower by Myron. Okay? So that's why if you want to see the Discobolus, you go to Munich, and it's still in the museum in Munich, because Hitler bought it and brought it from wherever it was, and it ended up in Germany, because he loved this classical. He loved that classical structure.
This might not be true, but I heard a story that for one of those modernist art exhibits that they put together, they made a program, and it had like bios of the authors, and then they have pictures of people with mental disabilities, like as their pictures.
Yeah, and that's going to come out, that's the realization in exhibit form of a line that, you know, you've probably read if you look through this already, which is that expressionists describe these deformed creatures, right? And what they're doing is giving rise to physical deformity and so on. So somehow culture is going to have an impact on the race that way, right? So then later on they obviously got some these. They got some photographs of
like just people.
Yeah, right. So, and they equate that then with expressionist distortion. Right. Yeah. Nice, huh? But the opposite, and this is universal in Western culture, the opposite of nervousness and sexual deviance and all the problems associated with it is the classical. Definition of beauty, which was based on really 18th century interpretations of Greek sculpture. And I can't go into that, but we did in the previous course, where people like J.J. Winckelmann and so on say, this is the ideal. This is representative of not only a good physique, but a good soul. Right? And from the 18th century on, that is really, in large part, at least in terms of official art, public art, the ideal. And in fact, the place where you can still find it is in American advertising. Right? For many people have done comparisons of the Marlboro Man and other, you know, iconographic advertising images of men, and then compared, said, oh, well, look, they had the same in Nazi Germany, and they had the same in Soviet Russia, and then they had the same in 18th century. Right? So that neoclassicism goes on. Okay, so let's get a little politics in here. Page 32. The internal composition of the 500 chosen representatives of the people with regard to profession or even individual abilities gives a picture incoherent as it is usually deplorable. Right? So putting together an assembly, right? How are you going to have any real leadership? No one can believe that these men elected by the nation are elect of spirit or even of intelligence. It is to be hoped that no one will suppose that the ballots of an electorate, which is anything else than brilliant, will give rise to a statesman by the hundreds. We cannot be too sharp in condemning the absurd notion that geniuses can be born from general elections. Okay? So, anti-democratic. Sooner will a camel pass through a needle's eye than a great man be discovered by an election. In world history, the man who really rises above the norm of the broad average usually announces himself personally. All right. So, obviously anti-democratic, but also this notion of the leader principle that's going to rise up on his own terms. And he's talking about himself. Right. He's talking about himself. Of course, anti-Semitism is behind this and linked to the anti-democratic. Any of your problems, you're going to link that up with the Jew, modern art, socialism, but also democracy as a whole. The bottom of page 33. That is why this type of democracy has become the instrument of that race which in its inner goals must shun the light of day, now, and in all ages of the future. Only the Jew can praise an institution which is as dirty and false as he himself. So here we are. They're commies, but they're also Democrats, right? As well as modernists, as well as slave traffickers, as well as, you know, responsible for industrialization, modernization, and all the things that those capitalist bankers are doing. So where's the truth in all of that, right? I mean, I'm sure you can find a Jewish person that's involved with all of those things. I don't know about white slave trafficking. But, you know, yes, they're there. They're present. Are they in control of any of them?
Back to modernism, I guess it fits in, or futurism, I guess it fits in with what we're talking about. I had always been under the impression from art history courses that futurism was really tied in with Italian fascism and representative
right.
of Mussolini's regime.
They pick up on it. Yeah, subsequently.
Okay.
Futurism pre-exists Mussolini. And that style is definitely incorporated into the totalitarian art of fascist Italy. And you have actually a very wonderful example of the style on this campus. The Chapel of Madonna della Strada is done by an Italian architect of the 30s, right, who comes from that string. The streamlined look is very much the style that was incorporated by the fascists in Italy. And it comes out of you know, the futurist streamlining, planes, trains, being interested in that. So that really neat, cool, clean line that Madonna della Strada has comes from that. Right?
Now, granted, we've already deduced that Hitler's a hypocrite. How?
Okay. Yes.
How does this embracing of futurism by the fascists?
Well, remember, the futurists themselves were tired of all this namby-pamby feminist, leftist, navel-gazing, you know, mental masturbation of expressionistic style artists. Okay, so they're not naive little kiddies, right? They think war is going to be beautiful, and they sign up for it in droves, or you know, they're overrepresented. You know, like all of them signed up, and very few of them survived. Right, so they have a sort of right-wing aggressive approach, and I don't know if it was attached to cultural national or to nationalism, but I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, they all ended up fighting and dying for the Italian cause. So it's not inconsistent for the right of Italy to have incorporated futurist technique, but it's contradictory to a kind of traditionalism, rejection of modernity, and so on. If you mean that,
yeah
well, just another one of these paradoxes. Let's write it down. Paradox. Major theme in German cultural history.
Or fashion cultural. You put together opposites, right? It's paradoxical. There's no way to square the circle or circle the square, right? Yes, they're anti-urban, and they're futuristic. And a very theoretical book written about this is called Reactionary Modernism.
And that's by someone named Jeff Herf, A-T-R-F. And he went through all the folkish conservative philosophy and analyze those. So it's dense textual analysis to show how this paradox existed all along. You know, they want to go back to a peasant village medieval economy. So that's the image, right? Without all this urban stuff, right? But you want battleships to, you know, too. So how do you put those two together? You have to have a combination of both. Okay, let's go ahead, bit of a jump to, what do I have next? All right, page 43. Here's a good one. In general, the art of all truly great national leaders at all times consists, among other things, primarily in not dividing the attention of a people, but in concentrating it upon a single foe. So here's a look into this propaganda technique. The more unified the application of people's will to fight, the greater will be the magnetic attraction of a movement, and the mightier will be the impetus of the thrust. Focus things on a single foe. It belongs to the genius of a great leader to make even adversaries far removed from one another seem to belong to a single category. Okay? Capitalists, communists, right? Futurists, right? You know, you could put that two together. People who are too far over in either of those sides. They're one. It's paradoxical, it's hypocritical, it's inconsistent, but it works. You blame them. All these problems, this wide range of very complex issues that modern life has to deal with, right? Well, you just blame one group for all of those problems. Simple. So there's that need for order. He taps into it, and he provides a sense of order, a sense of stability, a sense of clarity by not dealing with these problems on their own terms, you know, and going into all the issues that go into poverty and immorality in the cities and so on and so forth. You just blame it on the Jews. And then you could focus your masses that you're trying to rally behind you on that issue. It belongs to a genius of a great leader to make even adversaries far removed from one another seem to belong to the single category. Because in weak and uncertain characters, the knowledge of having different enemies can only too readily lead to the beginning of doubt in their own right. Right? So people will be confused, and they won't doubt. They'll begin to doubt themselves and the and the goals of the party. Once the wavering mass sees in itself a struggle against too many enemies, objectivity will put in an appearance. Oh, you wouldn't want them to be objective, right? Throwing open the question whether all others are really wrong and only their own people or their own movement are in the right, which is what they should think. Everyone's wrong, and we're right. This brings about the first paralysis of their own power, if they see things as being more complicated. Hence, a multiplicity of different adversaries must always be combined, so that in the eyes of the masses of one's own supporters, the struggle is directed against only one enemy. This strengthens their faith in their own right and enhances their bitterness against those who attack it. Right. So, that's the strategy. Right? And here's that consciousness, that awareness. Right? And, you know, it plays itself out in American advertising. You know, get rid of plaque. Get rid of those problems in your kitchen and your life's going to be better. Right? Focus on that particular issue. Just keep hammering at it with that. Right? And you'll sell a lot of Lysol. Okay, page 44. Back to the Jewish issue, but it's important. The anti-Semitism of the new movement was based on religious ideas instead of racial knowledge, which is what he thinks is necessary. So that racial anti-Semitism shows up. It is obvious that combating Jewry on such a basis could provide the Jews with a small cause for concern. If you continue to do it in a religious way, religious anti-Semitism, the Jews have nothing to worry about. If worse came to worse, a splash of baptismal water could always save the business and the Jew at the same time. With such a superficial motivation, a serious scientific treatment of the whole problem was never achieved. And as a result, far too many people to whom this type of anti-Semitism was bound to be incomprehensible were repelled. Right? So here's that shift again. But a clear, pretty clear statement of it. Okay, let's go ahead to, last few minutes here, let's go ahead to the World War, page 58. Try to do that part. Okay. Now, at the beginning of 58, we get a statement of this sense of, that the world just wasn't really going anywhere, that the world had sort of reached a stagnant point, things were boring, things were disorienting and so on, which was very common before the First World War. And someone like Dietrich really didn't have anything going on with his life, so he attached himself to the national cause, and that provided clarity, and military provided clarity. So very common, and Hitler articulates that here. As a young scamp in my wild years, nothing had so grieved me as having been born at a time which obviously erected its halls of fame only to shopkeepers and government officials. So there's nothing exciting about it. Ways of historic events seemed to have grown so smooth that the future seemed only belong to a peaceful contest of nations, cozy mutual swindling match. So this is this whole notion of cultural despair, that you know things had sort of reached a dead end before the war. And the war was exciting because it was going to allow people to go off and do these adventurous things, and leaders would arise out of that adventure and that experience and so forth. So I'll just skip over that for now, but it's a good example of that theme, which is very much part of the literature on the period, but here we have someone in someone's memoirs articulating the same thing. Now, then on page 59, this very famous passage, which I set up here. There's the photograph. There's Hitler. There he is. Mm-hmm. Well, he said that he was there. And then a photographer, actually he was his personal photographer named Hoffman. He went back, he had taken photographs there, so he went back and looked at all of his photographs. And he said, there he is. To me, those hours, this year of 1914, seemed like a release from the painful feelings of my youth. Even today, I'm not ashamed to say that, overpowered by stormy enthusiasm, I fell down on my knees and thanked heaven from an overflowing heart for granting me the good fortune of being permitted to live at this time. And obviously, he was not alone in thinking that, because everybody in those class. I, too, was one of these millions. So page 59. That war enthusiasm. Then on page 60, he goes into battle, and it is filled with a very romantic imagery. Not just being on a train and marching and being wet and cold and all the things that crop up in the critical views of the war, right? But it's very exhilarating. The day when we left Munich became the fulfillment of our duty. For the first time I saw the Rhine. He goes, passes the Rhine. He experiences that on the train. He sees the Rhine River as we rode westward along its quiet waters to defend it. The German stream of streams from the greed of the old enemy. That would be France. Through the Tendel veil of the early morning mist, the Nidewald monument, one of those folkish monuments that were put up in the 19th century that I had up here when we did our initial survey, gleamed down upon us in the gentle first rays of the sun. There's all that romantic. The sun, the river, the old watch on the Rhine, a song, 19th century military song, roared out of the endless transport train into the morning sky, and I felt as though my heart was burst. So there's that a romantic attachment to the war. Now, he claims, at the distance the strain of a song reached our ears, coming closer and closer, leaping from company to company, and just as death plunged a busy hand to our ranks in his first battle, the song reached us too, and we passed it along. Germany, Germany, above all in the world. So he claims that they were, you know, going into battle, singing the national anthem. Maybe true, becomes mythological. This was the beginning. Now, he goes through the battle, winter of 1915, 1916. Right? A young volunteer had become an old soldier. He's been toughened by this. Here's that right-wing version of it. This is the Ernst Jünger version of it. I've become a battle-hardened individual. I've been strengthened by all of this. And this transformation had occurred in the whole army. It had issued old and hard from the eternal battles. Those who could not stand up under the storm, well, they were broken. But those of us who made it, you know, didn't happen to get hit by a shell, I would say, right? But, right? Thousands of years may pass, but never will it be possible to speak of heroism without mentioning the German army and the World War. From the veil of the past, the iron front of the gray steel helmet will emerge, unwavering and unflinching, an immortal monument. Okay, I'll stop there because it's time, but, you know, this is that whole, all of that right-wing culture that you got the opposite of from Remarque, but that was so much part of that, of the interwar period. The First World War is central in all of this. It is. It can't be overlooked that Hitler was a front veteran. And the whole desire to have revenge and undo the Treaty of Versailles and so on and so forth was very real to him as well as to others. Great.